Welcome to Grumpy Strategists, episode 61. I'm your host, SAA's Michael Shoebridge, and I'm joined remotely by SAA's head of research, Dr. Marcus Hellier.
Bonjour.
Bonsoir.
Je suis en Paris. I'm in Paris. You know why, Michael?
I do.
Steel. We need steel.
We need a lot of steel.
We need a lot of steel. So our listeners probably aware that we're cracking on with Submarine Shipyard in Adelaide. Apparently, we're going to need the equivalent of 17 Eiffel Towers of steel for this massive erection.
Yep.
And, we could wait for the Aussie steel industry to pump that
Marcus,
out.
Marcus, but this delayed.
It would take the Australian steel industry a whole week to make that much steel. We can't wait.
We're going to make this happen.
So I'm just going straight to the source. I mean, is anybody really using the Eiffel Tower nowadays? It's pretty old. It's been around for a century. Well, it's meant to be temporary anyway.
I'm just saying, knock it down.
We'll use the Eiffel Tower. Gets cracking right
okay.
away.
Okay, look, I'd love to have joined you. I was down in Adelaide for the announcement.
Oh, you're in Adelaide, okay.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and Premier Malinauskas, and, of course, the august head of, still head of the Australian Submarine Agency, Grand Admiral Meade. And I was boggled. My mind was absolutely boggled at the announcement.
The whole thing is mind-boggling.
There was so much boggling that you were able to get on the plane to Paris to negotiate rights to the Eiffel Tower, but I was just wandering in a dazed circle of boggleness.
Well, I don't think you're the only person walking in a dazed circle of mind-bogglosity, because Mr. Malinauskas, the Premier of South Australia, was also admitting to a high degree of mind-bogglation as well.
So. He was. Well, I think the thing that really crystallised this announcement for me was from Premier Malinauskas. And he's in the middle of an election campaign. Maybe he's got some reasons for wanting to boost things. But this is what he said. Think about it. This is $30 billion before a single widget on the submarine has been procured. This is just the yard. It boggles the mind, Mr. Malinauskas explained.
It does boggle the mind that we're going to spend $30 billion before we actually get a widget. So how much are we going to spend getting widgets, and then how much are we going to spend putting those widgets together into blocks, and then spending money to put those blocks together into mega blocks, and then spending money to put the mega blocks into entire submarines?
Did you mention getting a submarine? You're getting way ahead of yourself, Marcus. There's so much benefit from this program and this spend before any submarine
actually
appeared.
But it is, according to Mr. Malinauskas, when he was able to sort of recover from being boggled, he says...
He coped well, actually.
We need to focus on how exceptionally large the ambition for this is, for the betterment of everybody. The betterment of everybody. But then he said the quiet bit out loud, none more so than future generations of South Australia.
Yeah, now look, I think I know what he meant there. And you made the point in our chat before the recording that this, like $30 billion before you start to even build a single submarine, is great news for South Australians in particular. That $30 billion Commonwealth fire hose, jobs for everyone, including your mate and your grandkids. But the other big thing is the deterrent effect of having started turning AUKUS into something
very
concrete. It's not just steel. There's a lot of concrete involved.
Well, if we turn back the clock, I remember former Prime Minister Scott Morrison talking about the deterrent effect that just the AUKUS announcement was going to have, that we would actually have a fleet of 8 submarines sometime approaching 2060, that back in 2021 already had a deterrent effect. Imagine what deterrent effect we have now that we have announced an actual shipyard that at some point will assemble widgets into blocks, into mega blocks, into submarines.
Yes. Well, look, I think this starts to get very real when your first blowtorch hits the first supporting star of the Eiffel Tower, because suddenly that steel is on its way. And we know adversaries don't like it up.
They don't like it up. I mean, I think this is already having a deterrent effect on anybody who's thinking of invading Australia sometime in the 2050s.
Particularly South Australia. See, I don't think Premier Malinauskas was just making a naked dash for Commonwealth taxpayer cash.
Oh my God, you were such a cynic to even suggest that.
About the betterment of all Australians, particularly future South Australians. I think he was saying South Australians are going to be the most secure Australians, not just topped up with Commonwealth taxpayer cash.
That's possibly true. Let's go through some of the details.
So it's very complicated because it's a very complex thing. So there's Area 1 and there's Area 2.
Yeah.
But then there is also, and this demonstrates to me the complexity anyway.
Area 3.
Area 3.
Yes.
There isn't an Area 4 at this stage.
Well, maybe Area 4 is the East Coast submarine base. And maybe that will be announced before the next New South Wales election.
I think that's Area 52. That's where the aliens are.
Anyway, there seems to be three areas. So Area 1 is for fabrication.
Is Area 1 the first area?
I think so.
Yes.
Well, see, this is the thing. Is like there was a media briefing and, you know, the ABC News actually has some pictures of this. There was some pictures in Defence Connect of some journos standing around in another big shed. Now, this big shed is the Hunter shed, but it is a pale shadow, apparently, of the future submarine building shed. But there was a photo of a couple of journos standing there. For some reason, this wasn't broadcast to the entire world. I'm not quite sure why, but
security.
But the aforementioned Grand Admiral Meade is pointing at a picture. So we have this sort of picture of a picture, and it says Area 1 and Area 2. And I can't see Area 3, but that's still a fair way away. Apparently, Area 3 is not going to be ready until sometime in the late 2030s. But Area 1 is fabrication.
Yeah.
I think that's, you know, where you make the big steel bits. Area 2 is outfitting. And then Area 3 is all of the secret nuclear stuff.
Nuclear.
So that comes at the end. And Area, so there's going to be apparently, you know, trying to sort of get at the numbers. The preliminary works is about $2 billion. The fabrication Area 1 is $5 billion. Area 2 apparently is $8 billion. And then the super secret spooky nuclear bit is $15 billion. So you add all that up together,
you get
and
30.
It's $30 billion.
Did I?
That number, you know, we talk about mega projects and how AUKUS is a giga project.
Yes.
I think this is not just mind-boggling. I think it's mind-mega-boggling. Or even mine, gigaboggling. It is so much money.
Isn't a bigger number a Google? So it's a mind Google boggling.
Could be mind Google boggling. Next time I see Mr. Melanaskis, I'll see if he's reached mind Google boggling.
I think the reason he's coping so well with this fire hose of Commonwealth cash being announced during his own election campaign.
It's only a coincidence. It's pure coincidence, Michael. Surely you're not saying the Federal Labor Party in power have announced this to maybe help their state colleagues? You're such a cynic.
No, but the Prime Minister's been quite clear about this. People have criticised the Prime Minister for not being a national security minister, but here he is. The construction of the state-of-the-art facility is expected to generate up to 5,500 jobs across the 75-hectare site. So the good thing here is this is all about our security, at least if you're South Australian, and it's job security for you.
Job security
involved in the AUKUS program.
Yes, this, once again, the whole issue of sort of the point of this somehow being about national security has sort of been lost in the gold rush for jobs and dollars.
And the bigliness of the sheds.
And the absolute big. You know how bigly this shed is, Michael?
How bigly is it?
420 metres.
Yes, but that's more than twice as big as the big shed that is in the picture of the reporting, which is, I thought that was a big shed.
This is much biglier. And apparently it's so bigly that none of the golf players playing in the LIV golf tournament, sponsored by Saudi Arabia, we'll just put that to the side, that was happening at the same time as this announcement, none of those golf players could hit a ball that far from one end of this amazingly bigly shed to the other.
Well, that's for two reasons. One, they can't hit the golf ball that far. Two, they won't be let in this shed, will they?
I don't know. I mean, if it's raining on the golf course, you could do it in the shed.
So you are getting hold of the Eiffel Tower for its steel.
Well, that's only the first step. First step, I've done my research. Next, I'm hopping on a plane, flying to San Francisco, Golden Gate Bridge. I mean, what an old relic, time to be replaced, but 80,000 tons of steel. So we put those two together. We're most of the way there with all the steel because we don't want to wait for a week's production of Australian steel.
How much steel do we need? 126,000?
126,000,
128,000. Premier or the Prime Minister or Jonathan Mees?
One of them said that. I think the Prime Minister. But that's about a week's production of the Australian steel industry.
Yeah, but we cannot wait.
We cannot wait.
We cannot wait.
So I reckon if we get the Eiffel Tower, the Golden Gate Bridge, and then there's just a bit left, sort of 40 to 50,000 tons, Sydney Harbour Bridge fits the bill.
You read my mind. I mean, that bridge is an eyesore in the harbour for a start. Well, Reason one for it to go. Reason two, it's historic. And as Richard Miles has so clearly said, sentiment is costly and inefficient. So I reckon we get the rest of the steel from the Sydney Harbour Bridge. We remove an eyesore. We get rid of historical baggage. And what's wrong with floating apartments over the site there?
Well, and the other thing is Premier Chris Minns of New South Wales has said these constant protests that we're seeing, the pro-Palestinian
protesting, constant protests form a risk
to community cohesion. You know, all that bridge does nowadays is support protests walking across it. So let's just chop down the bridge, restore social cohesion, and build that shed.
It's not a bridge anymore. It's a source of division.
I know.
It's not. We need to build bridges, and we'll do that best by cutting this one down and reusing the steel.
So anyway, if we do that, we can start work on this soon. Now, one of the reports, Defence Connect, actually had some dates in there, which any date relating to the submarine program I treat as gold, because unfortunately, Grand Admiral Meade, despite requests from Senate committees to disclose dates around the schedule for the submarine program, for whatever reason, we don't seem to get those dates. So we have actually gotten a few snippets here from Defence Connect. I have to say, I haven't been able to ground truth them.
Yes.
I have no reason to question these dates. But what are the dates? Well, Areas 1 and 2 are expected to be completed by the mid-2030s.
Okay. Right, good. And Area 3?
That by the late 2030s.
Well, in the ABC report, it actually says construction will be complete in 2040.
I'm trying to
keep this simple. There's a lot of complexity here, what with three areas.
But
these three areas combined are needed to build the submarine, is what I'm assuming.
Yes. But look, you only need the first one to start the construction. Right. So this is for Area 1 from this story completed mid-2030s. Now, the only problem, I'm not saying it's a problem.
No.
It's just an issue that strikes me as I don't know. I'm sure
it's a challenge.
I'm sure Grand Admiral Meade has got this all sorted out in the grand plan.
Yeah. Well, he will have left the job. I think that's the best way of him putting that behind him.
But when I go and look at what the ASA is on the Australian Submarine Agency is on the record as saying for when construction of the submarines, not the shed, but the submarines, it's meant to start in the 2020s. But the shed that it's meant to happen in isn't going to be finished until the mid-2030s. So I'm just sort of wondering, is part of this process developing time warp eons, you know, this new subatomic particle that will allow the ASA
to do time travel?
To do time travel. And once they finish the shed in the mid-2030s,
they will travel back,
go back to the late 2020s to start construction.
I think that does simplify all of the schedules here, because I had that same conceptual problem that a lot of people just looking at this from outside would have. You know, so if it's going to take you from now in 2026 to 2040 to finish the facility you're going to build the submarines in, it's going to be hard for you to be building submarines in them before those sheds are finished. I did have that thought myself.
Well, that's the third shed, Michael, and that's the nuclear bit.
But even when you start... So I do think this reveals a schedule problem for SSN AUKUS. It's probably made Electric Boat happy because they may have some more orders.
It won't be like that.
There was another thing that struck me about this, which was again, it was Jonathan Mead that came out with this. He said, this will be the most modern shipyard for building submarines on the planet.
Well, one would hope so.
Yeah. Well, it will be.
It'll be the newest one. I mean, this is the. I mean, call me bitter and cynical. I do find it annoying when we have all of these media conferences, which the public's not doesn't have access to, but put that aside. We have all of these stories in the media, and they just tell us things which I would categorize as the bleeding obvious. We're going to build a brand new shipyard.
It'll be modern.
And guess what? It's going to be the most modern shipyard in the world. Oh, you mean we're not going to build a shipyard with like 1950s technology?
Well, hold on, because he went on to say that the manufacturing process would be identical to the shipyard building submarines in the UK.
In the aforementioned shed, yes.
And here's another quote from him. Their facilities are 120 years old. Ours will be the most modern submarine yard in the world. Now, I think he must mean things other than BAE's submarine building facility, because they've only been building nuclear submarines since the 60s, which is not 120 years ago. But maybe they invented the time travel a technology, and that's why we've got to build them the same, because otherwise we can't do that.
Well, but yes,
I did think to myself, so we're building the most modern facilities with $30 billion.
Yes,
it's taking us at least 15 years. When we finish them, they'll be brand new, spanking new, best in the world, but we're insisting on building them to manufacture in exactly the same way that the older facilities in the UK have. And that led me to think, Marcus, how does the UK, what's their manufacturing process? Is it this fully integrated robotic facility, or is it a little more old-fashioned in some ways?
You mean like, so that bit where they take the blocks, the big tubes,
yep,
and actually put them on a truck and carefully, laboriously negotiate them down the main street of Barrow-on-Furness, carefully avoiding these 100-year-old cottages and pubs so they can take them from one part of the yard to the big assembly shed. Are we going to copy that, Michael, if we're going to do it the same way? So are we going to put our blocks on a truck, do a lap of Adelaide to make sure we do it the same way, and then drive it into the big assembly shed?
Look, it will be the same distance that it takes to get from BAE's Area 1 to their Area 2, for us to go from Area 1 to Area 2. So I'm hoping, actually, some of this $30 billion is to help recreate some key features of Barrow in Furness to enable the manufacturing. So one thing is obvious. We need at least one replica pub.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very nice one, apparently. Jefferson's Hotel and Bar on Duke Street in Barrow. It's a little pricey, but that's where some of the BAE workers go.
So we're not going to have Disneyland. We're going to have Barrow and Furness Land.
Yes.
So we can drive our big submarine blocks laboriously down the main street, trying not to crush, you know, the bystanders.
Yeah, we're going to
just so we can build our submarines exactly the same way as they do it in a 120-year-old shipyard.
Yeah, maybe we don't need to do the whole, like the buildings along that street. We just create the facade.
A facade.
Because the manufacturing process
needs to be the
same.
Well, it wouldn't be the first facade in this whole program, but anyway.
But I was mind-boggled to hear.
Mind-boggled or mind-mega-boggled or mind-Google-boggled?
Well, I'm still coming out of the bogglification, so I think I was probably at least giga-boggled.
Okay.
And I wasn't coping as well as Premier Malinauskas, but to me, it is actually mind-boggling to be spending $30 billion of pretty rare taxpayers' money and taking 15 years before we can start to make, as Premier Malinauskas said, the first widget for a submarine. Because I remember the other biggest program in Australian defence history, the JSF program, we spent about $19 billion. But the trick with that is we got some aircraft.
Well, a mere 72 aircraft.
So,
and I think we actually declared full operational capability.
So I cannot celebrate an announcement that says we're going to spend $30 billion building some construction facilities and then the expense has only just begun.
Oh,
and we've
got
no capability. I just can't celebrate that.
Why do you insist on raining on everybody else's mind-boggling?
It does boggle the mind, but in an outrageously wasteful use of public resources. And the incoherence of it's going to be the most modern facility on the planet, but we're going to insist and make it exactly the same way as they make it in the old facilities in the UK. I just think the whole thing is just gibberishical.
Gibberishical?
Yeah, you see, I'm boggled. I can't even speak English.
Oh, my God. You know, there we go. 420-metre hall, and you're just writing it off. But another thing to note about this is none of this verbiage has actually said where the $30 billion is coming from. So is that coming out of the Defence Department's budget? Is it part of the 268 to 368, or is it a separate number? Or is this going to be some kind of off-the-books Department of Finance
like
thing?
A lot of the Australian naval infrastructure spending.
We'll do, you know, an equity injection into Australian naval infrastructure, which will own it, but then they'll rent it back to BAE, and then BAE will actually charge it back to the Australian taxpayer to cover their costs of renting the facility from the Australian taxpayer.
You know, a lot of the
it never appears.
A lot of the
books.
Complexity in the AUKUS program is financial engineering, isn't it? So I think you're right. We get the Prime Minister and Premier announcing this mega-boggling spend of $30 billion. Then we hear that there's a down payment of $3.9 billion, and then it'll all be massaged off books so it doesn't look like it's actually affecting the Commonwealth budget.
Mm-hmm. I like how this $3.9 billion down payment. Like, why are we doing a down payment? Is that
there's a very good reason?
We're worried that somebody else is going to come in and snatch it from us. I mean,
I blame Jeff Kennett for this. You know, a lot of people will remember this. You know, we've got our main facility in the Brindabellas, the bunker in the ACT. There was a time here in Canberra when our greatest fear was that the then Victorian Premier Jeff Kennett was going to steal Floriade, the big flower show held every year in Canberra. He was going to be like the Grinch or a thief in the night. Mm. And so putting a down payment on this Osborne submarine facility stops the Chinese establishing one there, stops the Russians establishing one there.
I hope they have effective anti-gazumping laws in South Australia. I mean, what if the Chinese come along and say, $3.9 billion, that's not a down payment. Here's six. Take that. I'll show you your lousy $3.9 billion. That's my shipyard now.
Part of the Maritime Silk Road.
Well, I mean,
and turning them down would offend them, wouldn't it? And that would put us off the correct path relationship.
Like Mr. Malinowskis has never seen a truckload of cash he's been able to say no to. But
could he say no to renminbi, though? They'd probably be willing to convert it to Australian dollars. And I think they've left it too late. The campaign's going to be over. So another thing about this construction in Australia. I don't know if you've heard people like the head of the National Construction Industry Association. They've been saying, look, all these big infrastructure and building programs and the housing crisis, the thing we need more of is migrants for our construction.
No, migrants are bad. Think of social cohesion, Michael.
Well, I wonder if the Premier down in South Australia is realising he's going to have to truck in skilled migrant workers to help build these mind-boggling facilities. Some of these jobs are not going to go to native South Australians, damn it. They're going to go to foreigners.
Well, I'm a bit confused on the whole immigration thing at the moment, I have to say, because we had the opposition saying that, well, the way for them to actually become credible in Australia, once again, was to not outdo one nation.
Two-nation them.
You know, they had to go back to their traditional liberal values and appeal to, you know, the traditional sort of liberal voter.
Yep. Free market, hard working,
but here
free
we
speech.
Are like 2 days into Angus Taylor's reign, and it looks to me like they're trying to out-one-nation.
I suppose we've got two things going on, haven't we? We've got the controversy over the ISIS wives and children that are trying to get out of Syria and for some reason want to come back to the country where they're citizens. And we've also got this idea that, you know, one of the first planks for the Liberal Party under Angus Taylor's leadership will be a clampdown on immigration.
Well, yeah, we sort of have this weird thing where Angus Taylor saying, oh, this idea of blocking, banning, barring immigration from certain countries and or areas that just happen to apparently have large numbers of extremist Muslims. We haven't seen any evidence of that, but okay. So Angus Taylor's saying, no, I know nothing about this. This was Susan Ley.
Yeah.
You know, Susan just sort of came up with this on the back of it.
She was doing all kinds of stuff.
You know, yeah. Crazy idea. I had nothing to do with this. Mm. But then he's sort of saying, but that's not a bad idea. Maybe we should do this. Well, this does seem to be not a traditional Liberal Party approach to immigration.
No, in fact, I think previous incarnations of the Liberal Party were quite into skilled migration and realising that a lot of our economic growth came from net migration.
Yeah, as long as you don't come on a boat.
Yeah.
As long as you've got a visa, we actually want high levels of immigration.
Well, you know, back to the connection to the AUKUS facility. So we've got this crunch in the construction workforce. We do need to have foreign people enter our construction industry, but also our health system, our aged care system. Anyone who's been to an Australian hospital or anywhere that cares for the elderly, you will notice a lot of the skilled workers, you know, the nurses, the other staff, they were not born in Australia. They were trained somewhere like Nepal or the Philippines or the subcontinent, and we have brought them here under our immigration scheme.
Surely you're not saying we've poached skilled workers from developing countries, but well, we have. So unfortunately, I've had to spend quite a lot of time in Australian hospitals in the last year or so because of family health issues. And I can tell you now that if we somehow stop immigration or reduce immigration from a lot of countries, our health system will collapse. Our health system will collapse overnight. Now, the problem is I don't think the coalition, the Liberal Party, are saying we want to stop all immigration. The problem is that we just get this weird kind of blancmange of messaging, some of which is, I think, a legitimate discussion about, you know, how many skilled migrants should we have, you know, which skills, and for the people who are not skilled, you know, how many humanitarian migrants, how many family reunions. We need to look at that holistically
and
balance demand for skilled workers versus pressure on housing prices, on infrastructure,
government services.
Legitimate discussion to be had there. Unfortunately, we don't seem to be able to have that sensible discussion because immediately a whole bunch of other stuff gets injected in, such as social cohesion or Australian values or potential terrorists. And so it just becomes this horrible mess where we don't have any kind of coherent, sensible conversation. And that is also going on in this Liberal Party dog whistling.
It's not even dog whistling.
No, they are explicitly saying, we're going to ban migrants from a bunch of areas. Why? Well, because there's extremist Muslims there. So the fact that you may be somebody living there going, I don't actually want to live in a place full of extremist Muslims because I'm a moderate Muslim or I'm a Christian or I'm gay or I just don't want to be here. Well, you're tarred with the same brush and we don't want you.
Yeah, well, I did hear a Liberal senator, it was Dave Sharma, he's been quoted, I heard him on the radio actually, so I heard him say it, about the ISIS wives and children that are stuck in Syria and trying to get home, about 34 of them, I think. Mm-hmm. He said, well, you know, these people, despite a whole lot of warnings, government warnings and other warnings at the time, made their decision to travel there. They've made their decision, and that's why we don't want them back. Mm-hmm. They made their decision. Well, you know, to me, there's a much more fundamental thing at work here. These ISIS wives are still Australian citizens, and we cannot escape our obligations to them. So our government has an obligation to all Australian citizens, even ones that they don't like. So
you mean just as we have an obligation to allow free speech, even if we disagree with what people are saying?
Well, this gets me.
We have an obligation to allow people to assemble and protest, even if we don't like what they're protesting about.
Yep. So they may have made a choice to travel to Syria.
Well, I don't think their babies did.
But their children probably didn't. So we're actually visiting the decisions of the parents on the children, and that to me is another wrong thing to do. But it doesn't really matter what they have or haven't done. They're Australian citizens. We have an obligation to take them back. And if they're a danger, well, it's Australia's job and our authorities' job to deal with that danger, not inflict it on other countries whose citizens they are not.
Okay, well, the problem with that somewhat nuanced view, Michael, is A, there doesn't seem to be a lot of votes in it. Certainly politicians don't think there's votes in it. Mm. I'm not so sure. But
I think there could be.
And the other thing is it means you can't jump up and down in the media saying you're tough on terrorism, you're tough on radicals, you're tough on extremism. But and it's also we have this concept of social cohesion, which is everywhere now.
Yes.
You know, commentators are using it, politicians are using
we
it.
We don't have enough of
the
it.
The cops are using it. Yeah. And it's being used to justify all kinds of things. And it's a bit like the free speech thing. It's like, I'm a big fan of free speech until you say something I disagree with. And so social cohesion, it's like, well, you know, I want people to be able to do what they want. But as soon as you do anything I disagree with, you're undermining social cohesion. But
I think you're right.
What is it?
Well, I think the one area where we could say the coalition are committed to net zero is in accepting different opinions on certain issues. So to me, a lot of this public discussion of social cohesion is, look, it's all very well to have views, but there's only one view on this issue. Like, there's only one view about whether these ISIS wives and their children should be brought back, and they shouldn't be brought back. There's only one view about the Bondi attack, and that is that clearly immigration is a part of this problem.
Mm.
Now, it's very inconvenient around the people that want to make the Bondi attack an immigration issue to find that the dead father and the son, who are the alleged murderers who seem to have been caught on lots of footage killing people.
I think they are murderers. Yes. I don't think there's a lot of dispute around that.
He's got to go through the court, but the killers are homegrown. So the dad had been in Australia for about 27 years from India, which I don't think is one of these exclusion zone hotbeds
or Angus Taylor's
that might
list
be being thought of.
I mean,
and the son is Aussie born and bred. But even more inconveniently for attaching the Bondi attack to this idea of extremist migrants turning up is the guy that saved lives, probably stopped 20 or more other people being killed.
The Syrian greengrocer.
Recent Syrian migrant who was working for the Syrian police, I think, under the Assad regime. So we probably wouldn't let that guy in. Thank God we let him in, or we would have more people killed on the beach. So all of that, in this quest for social cohesion, you're not meant to mention. You're meant to sign up to this view that right-thinking Australians would never do this, even though right-thinking Australians have done the mass terrorist events in our history, whether it's the Port Arthur massacre, the Australian who killed the New Zealand people at the mosque in Christchurch, and this latest Bondi attack, all Aussie, homegrown mass murderers.
I don't actually see a lack of social cohesion in Australia.
No.
I mean, we're not a country where we're seeing separatist movements. We're not seeing cities or states or territories wanting to separate.
Except for Western Australia.
Yeah, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Good point.
So the Eastern Seaboard.
You know, and all this stuff you hear about, La Kemba, places like that, you know, they're no-go zones. You know, cops won't go there. Really? I don't really think that's the case. So I'm not actually seeing a lack of social cohesion.
I actually think it'd be a much better national discussion to remind ourselves that one of Australia's strengths as a community and society is our diversity. And we enjoy that diversity. We've benefited from it enormously. And that does not mean insisting on one view on political issues. And it also doesn't mean stamping down on protesters who aren't being violent and may have views that the government of the day doesn't like. In a democracy, you enable that. You don't repress it.
Well, this is one of the most depressing things, I think, is so. You know, recently we saw in Minneapolis, ICE agents killed some people on the street.
Well, they might have been ICE agents. They were so heavily masked we couldn't see who they were.
So these were people who were killed, and I think most people watching that would go, this was completely unjustified.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing the Trump administration did was to back the ICE agents to the hilt, saying, you know, we absolutely trust them and these people got shot, they're asking for it.
Yeah, it's their fault.
And we look at this and go, well, that's, you know, outrageous. Yeah. There was not even an attempt to go, well, oh, we'll have to look at the evidence, review the footage, we'll do a proper investigation before we can judge.
Yep.
But what's the first thing that Christopher Minns, the Premier of New South Wales, did after the demonstration in Sydney
around
with footage of, you know, police holding people down on the ground and punching them in the kidneys?
Yes.
The first thing he did was to say, the police have my absolute backing.
Yeah. You're right. I thought there was a real echo of some of the worst behaviour we're seeing out of the Trump administration with that reaction. And it's back to this. You've got to remember the principles that are involved here. So we should be trying to protect our civil liberties, our freedom of speech and our freedom of association, and remembering that the job of our authorities is to enable those freedoms, and that's a particularly important thing for them to understand when the views that are being expressed are ones they vehemently disagree with. You know, what's that saying? You know, I disagree with them completely, but I'll fight to the death to protect their right to speak. That should be the value that we're talking about, not this dog whistling about they come from the wrong place.
Well, I mean, one of the ironies is I think if you looked at most of the people demonstrating in Sydney, marching across the Sydney Harbour Bridge, they actually look like pretty middle-class Anglo-Australian people, many of them.
Well, look,
in fact, many of them are Jews.
Yeah. I don't have a lot of time for the superficial attachment to international causes and the sort of vicarious emotion that people feel when they've got actually no stake in the issues. But I do believe in freedom of association, right to speak your mind, and right not to be beaten up by the police when you do so. Mm-hmm. So, and that to me is most important. As I say, if I happen to disagree with what the protesters are saying, we shouldn't insist on only right-thinking people being able to do certain things.
I would agree with that, Michael.
Yeah. But anyway, Marcus, you've got work to do. I'm distracting you.
Yep, I've got to work out how to get, I think, 7,300 tonnes of French steel back to Australia.
And I will brook no delay. This, my mind has to continue to be boggled, and it will
mega boggled.
It will be boggled if you can get that French steel to help us build an Aussie submarine. And wouldn't that be poetic? I'm sure the French would love to know that French steel is being used to build Australian submarines.
The irony is not lost on me.
There's still a part of the
action. Probably will not be lost on President Macron either.
No, good to talk with you, Marcus.